Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Vermont has a rather large number of nonprofits for its size, and they're doing some extraordinary things, some of which you get to hear about on this program. It means that there are a lot of people writing grant proposals to keep their mission for social change in action. These are great ideas serving a public need that need to be funded in some way. Thank goodness for Barbara Florish. She's been in the business of writing grant proposals for several decades, and she's just released her second book on the subject called You Have a Hammer, Building Grant Proposals for Social Change. And Barbara joins us now. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint, Barbara.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Rick. I appreciate you putting me on the air.
I'd love to have you. And listeners, if you'd like to ask a question or have a comment about writing grant proposals, give us a call, 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Barbara, let's get me and everyone up to speed. Tell us how nonprofits are funded.
Well, there's a lot of different ways nonprofits are funded. For one thing, they raise money from individuals. They get donations. They do events. They may have annual fund drives. Sometimes nonprofits charge for their services, like for counseling or some other service they provide. And then often nonprofits seek grant support from foundations, corporate foundations, and government agencies. And found that nonprofits receive a lot of grant support. That's one of the biggest sources of income for many nonprofits.
Barbara, you make a very specific point in the book to explain that most people who say they're grant writers aren't really grant writers, so you better explain.
Right. You know, I'm not really an evangelist on this issue, but
I know.
But just to make the point that when you write a proposal, develop a grant proposal, there's so much more to it than writing. Writing's sort of the tip of the iceberg. And so, for one thing, calling yourself a grant writer doesn't capture all you do if you're doing the work in the way that I define as doing it right, meaning doing it for social change. And so, you're more than a writer. You're a planner. You pull together people to collaborate with you to get something done. Then you put a proposal out to a funding agency, a foundation, a corporation. And then that funder decides whether or not to make a grant award, and then they write that award to you. So, you know, it's ubiquitous in the field, that term. And so I'm not going to beat anybody over the head with this, but just to say that I personally don't use it because I don't think it captures the depth of the work.
We're not going to change the world today by changing that title and the activity that the grant proposal writer is doing. I guess.
No, not today.
Okay. All right. Barbara, what's the significance of the title of the book, You Have a Hammer?
Grant proposals, when done right, are tools for social change. That's what they basically are. The only reason you would write a proposal is to try to get some money to address a problem, to make something better, or maybe to offer an opportunity to people in the community who do not have it. So everything you do, when you really focus proposals on change rather than money, is social activism. And so if you think about a grant proposal, it's not really a request for money. Yes, it is, of course. You're asking for money, but money's not the big part of that transaction. The transaction is really about the funder and the applicant agreeing together that we want a partner to make this specific change happen.
So how'd you come up with the name You Have a Hammer?
Well, I've been working on this book for about 4 years, and obviously it's a small book, so not straight that whole time, but it's distilled what I wanted to put out into the grants community about how to do the work to make real change happen. And so I was going to name the book The Little Green Book of Grantsmanship, and the people I'm working with, the publisher, said, no, that doesn't say anything about what it is.
Right.
So then I said, okay, well, then let's do it, Grants as Tools for Social Change. And they said, not quite right. So we were kind of having not a heated debate, but a discussion. And I said, but when you have when you do grant proposal work right, you have a tool, you have a hammer. And everybody said that's the name of the book.
Oh, fabulous. Now, you've raised millions of grant dollars, trained thousands of people to write grant proposals. So why write this book, which is your second?
Well, the first book was a updating and expansion of the seminal work in the field. So I was really proud of that. And it's a how-to book and how to do the work, how to make a logical argument and that sort of thing. But I've taught so many people and seen so many people come into my classes all over this country and beyond. And they're told by their bosses often, go get a grant, any grant, we need money. And so often they run out and get some sort of grant funding, and then when they bring it into the organization, it's sort of like a flash in the pan. You know, after the grant is gone, the impact is gone. So, and I've seen grants people, when they're not supported in doing the work right, actually making decisions that drive the direction of their organization, which is not the way that should happen.
Why is that wrong, to get a grant, any grant, money that keeps your mission going?
It's the reason sometimes you can have a good impact like that accidentally, but the notion is that if you have an organization with a mission and a strategic plan and you have priorities, that you don't want a grants person running around and grabbing every dollar, because when you bring in those dollars, you've got to deliver whatever that grant proposal said it was, and it starts driving the direction in the organization in this direction or that, which might not be right on spot on with its mission, and which is often not spot on with the strategic plan or priorities. And so you can easily get into mission drift if you say, oh, there's some money, I can do it, if I kind of move a little away from my mission, but I want the money. So it over time erodes the effectiveness of the organization in really pursuing the reason for which it exists, which is its mission.
So the grants come with very specific direction or kind of a set of criteria for that grant?
Whatever you write in your proposal, whatever you say you will do, you are then obligated to do. So there are some types of grants. For example, there's a type of a grant award called general operating. And so if you go to a foundation or a corporate foundation and say, we're doing great work, please give us money to keep doing what we're doing, sometimes that money comes in without too many strings. They say, great, keep doing what you're doing and let us know that you're doing it. But most of the time, funders fund very specific things. I was just talking to a national podcaster yesterday, and he had been hired right out of college to work in a social service agency. And without any direction, they just said, oh, there's an opportunity from HUD. Go apply for this money. He went and applied for it and brought in a huge grant to do a project for the homeless, for people who are experiencing homelessness. Now, it wasn't a bad thing that they implemented those services, but those services were outside of the mission of the organization. And later, the organization turned that whole program over to another organization. And he gave me other stories like that of just taking off after the money. And even though it wasn't a bad thing they were doing, that grant obligated them, that grant award obligated that organization to fulfill very specific activities and outcomes, produce outcomes that weren't spot on with the mission.
So, Barbara, what is at the heart of great grant proposal writing?
The heart of it is that you're driven by community needs and community opportunities rather than by money, so that you let that drive what you go after, and you coordinate it with your strategic plan, with your organizational priorities. And then I also would say that you coordinate it within the larger community so that your work enhances and builds other work in the community rather than replicates it. Now, you got to know how to write, because if you can't write, you can't communicate.
Right.
But the writing part of it is communicating this plan or this response to community need, and then laying out an approach for how you're really going to make a dent in that, a positive change in that. So I'd say it all comes from working from a perspective of change making rather from a perspective of money grabbing. So I think that's the difference.
Can you give me a specific example? I'm sure you've been through this many times with many different organizations, but maybe a specific example where this lines up, where it's coordinated, where there's this synergy between the grantor and the nonprofit receiving the grant.
Well, my favorite example is Return House in Barrie, the transitional living home for young men coming out of jail. Hmm. I was driving home one night from work, and I heard on the radio some statistics that were alarming about the number of young men in Barrie who were associated with corrections, who were on probation and jail, that sort of thing. And I also learned that once the young people got out, they were, it was a revolving door, in and out, because there were not services for them, transitional services in the community. So started talking to people about that with the help of my executive director, who supported it fully, but just started talking to everybody I could talk to. What needs to happen? Churches, the community justice center, funders. I would call and talk to funders even if I didn't want money from them. 4 years later, it took 4 years, that project became a reality, and it did not start until we had figured out, once it was open, how it would keep going, because that would have been a travesty to all of the community organizing and meetings and discussions, and it would have served no purpose. So that, to me, is real change-making. When you look at something that's happening in the community and say, this needs to change, and then you go out and work with all those systems and all those groups and community groups and people, and then once you decide altogether how it can happen, then you say, okay, we need to get some money, let's start this up, but how can we keep it going? And so that's change making through grants work.
Barbara, what are some of the pitfalls that grant proposal writers can fall into?
One thing is it's a highly stressful job because it's very deadline driven. And so just on a personal level, proposal writers often work nights and weekends, have hard deadlines. So it's stressful. And I know it is myself, because it was for me, it has been for me, but also just from talking to people all over. The other thing is you can fall into the habit of isolating yourself or trying to get off into a corner and think up a program or write a response to application guidelines by yourself without bringing it to the broader, your colleagues out in your organization and then into the broader community. A big problem is when you think in isolation, where you don't consider what else is happening in your community. It oftentimes, the sorts of issues or problems you're going to try to approach or help make better, ameliorate with a grant proposal, other people, other organizations in the community might not be doing exactly what you're doing, but your missions probably intersect. Mm. And so it's important to reach out to organizations with intersecting missions to see if you can work together, because you bring more muscle to the problem. So it all has to do with those sort of primary things that I talk about in this book. The full name of the book is You Have a Hammer, Building Grant Proposals for Social Change. And it speaks to things like ethics and evaluation, that you need to evaluate, that collaboration is imperative, that you need to work out in the community and let that drive you. And so if you slip into go get a grant, any grant, because we need money within our organization, mm-hmm. that thinking will eventually erode your ability to be strong in addressing any particular issue in your mission.
And I would imagine.
Does that answer it?
Yeah, it does. And it's a brilliant answer. And you've got me thinking, you know, that act of just going out and getting any dollars, you could be taking away grant money that would better suit an organization that could fill that need, already is set up to do most of that already. And you're now kind of forging new area within your organization that you really don't need to go to. And like you say, stick to your strength, stick to your core mission.
Absolutely, Rick. That really says it well. And I have seen that happen. I've seen that happen. And it's really a shame, because the whole notion is that nonprofits strengthen the community, and they do. I love that you had a public service announcement or ad by that nonprofit just now, because how many of us have not been touched by the services of nonprofits? And so it's unfortunate, but they're usually short on money. They're always trying to get donations. They're going out for grant, making grant proposals, trying to get awards. Sometimes they have state contracts and this sort of thing. But how much poorer would we be as a community and as a society without nonprofits, which are basically one of our primary social service nets, security nets, or whatever you call that, you know, in this country. Nonprofits play that role to do a lot of things that government does not do.
Let's get back to writing these grant proposals. So what skills does someone have to develop to really excel as a grant proposal writer?
Oh, I love that, because this goes to my how-to book.
All right.
Which is Grantsmanship, Program Planning, and Proposal Writing. You have to know how to make a logical, well-supported argument. And so in training myself, I read things like books on communication theory or the theory of how you make arguments, because you have to be able to prove, to say, this is a situation that concerns us, that is driving us to take action. This is how we know it exists in the community and to what degree it does exist. And then this is what we want to do about this. These are the approaches we want to take in solving or at least ameliorating this problem in some way. And then this is why we know these approaches will work. So you're hearing a lot of research here. And finally, these are the specific measurable changes in that problem that we expect this approach to produce. Mm. So you're making an argument. It's always supported with facts and figures and hard data and soft data. Soft data being more anecdotal, hard data, facts and figures, things you can measure. So you've got to know how to make an argument and support it. I was on the debate team in high school many, many years ago, and that was some of the best training for putting together a logical, compelling grant proposal.
I'm going to flip the script now and go from, you know, the nonprofit side to the grant awarding side. First of all, who are these? What are these organizations that are awarding grants?
Okay, there's a universe of them. The term philanthropy usually refers to corporate foundations and private foundations. Private foundations may be a family foundation that just has, the family has money, they want to be philanthropic. So they're private foundations such as the Gates Foundation or corporate foundations such as National Life as a foundation. But then there are government agencies that make grant awards. Now, I want to skip back to the foundations for a minute. Mm-hmm. Those foundations have missions and priorities just like our nonprofits do. So what nonprofits are looking for are those foundations where the missions match. It has to be what I call a good fit funder. But then you go to government grants. Government grants certainly come from the federal government. They make billions of dollars in grants every year, but also from state taxes and revenues. Some counties, L.A. County, where I've worked a lot, Los Angeles, their county's bigger than the whole state of Vermont. They make a lot of grants. why do they make grants? They make grants to get things accomplished that they don't want to accomplish their own or set up all their internal systems to do on their own as a government. So they make grants to address problems and issues usually that need to be solved, like grants for research on COVID vaccine, for example, that sort of thing. They also make grants because sometimes they're told to by their legislative bodies. The legislature will say, or the Congress will say, we're real concerned about this. Do a grant program to solve it here, Department of Justice, catch. So these are, there are both government and what I call private grant makers. And when you add all of the grant money up, whether it comes from government or private sources, it's a tremendous amount of money that equals or exceeds personal donations. It's just that within philanthropy, they usually don't count government because it's public money rather than private money.
Barbara, we only have about a minute left, but what else can you tell us what people will learn from reading You Have a Hammer?
I really wrote the book for people who don't understand how to go about the work. I call it a why to book. Why you need to think about this work in a certain way if you really want to make change. And so you need to learn your how to's. You need to know how to make an argument. But I want you to really focus first on the why you need to think about it in a certain way if you are going to be this specific kind of activist.
It sounds like you're still really enjoying, though, being part of this business of helping people write these grant proposals.
I do enjoy it. I really love the results. I mean, I've heard from numerous students. In fact, I trained recently online, of course, a woman who was running a addiction recovery house in New Hampshire. And after that class, she wrote back a month later to say that she had applied for 4 different grant awards and gotten every one of them, which brought about $200,000 into their addiction recovery program.
That is fantastic.
That's pretty rewarding.
Yeah. Barbara Flourish has been writing grant proposals and training people how to do so effectively for over 40 years. Her second book has just been published called You Have a Hammer, Building Grant Proposals for Social Change. Barbara, thank you so much for sharing your expertise this morning.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really enjoyed it.
Great. You're welcome. We're going to pop out for the CBS News update. When we return, we're going to be biking and hiking on the Kingdom Trails.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. If you appreciate the beauty of the Northeast Kingdom, great mountain bike trails, good hunting spots, or just a nice stroll in the woods, then there's good news coming out of Linden. The nonprofit Kingdom Trails has now conserved 270 acres on Darling Ridge. That ridge, once owned by alleged fraudster Ariel Quiros, forms the heart of the Kingdom Trails network, and this news ensures that it will stay that way forever. Kingdom Trails Executive Director Abby Long joins us now to talk about the new arrangement. Abby, I'm sorry I got your name a little butchered there, but welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you so much. Good morning. And I'm thrilled to be here.
I'll work on that very difficult to pronounce Abby Long name throughout this interview. All right. And listeners, we'd love to hear your questions or your experiences using Kingdom Trails. You can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Every time I have someone on to discuss what's happening in the kingdom, this is the truth, they mention Kingdom Trails as a big part of what's going on in the NEK. So either you have a lot of people.
That's amazing.
So either you have a lot of people on retainer or this is a big deal. So explain first what Kingdom Trails is.
Absolutely. Well, Kingdom Trails, where do I even start? It is a nonprofit, as you've mentioned. We are a trail network that hosts 100 plus miles of trails. And it's more than just mountain biking. We have hikers, runners, and now in the middle of the winter, we have Nordic skiers, fat bikers, and snowshoers. And we even share some of our trails with the VAST network. So we're multi-used. And we really exist. Our mission is to provide education and recreation opportunities in order to foster the health of our local community, of course, but our surrounding environment and most importantly, our regional economy. As we all know, the kingdom has some challenges. and before I go any further, I really have to mention that the whole reason Kingdom Trails exists is due to 100 private landowners that just generously allow our trails to cross their beautiful properties every day. I'm just so overwhelmed and grateful for those, my neighbors, who allow us to live happily and healthily.
What area does it encompass?
Yeah, we're in Caledonia County, but actually just the other year we crossed over into Essex County. So we are in Burke, Lindenville, Kirby, and East Haven.
And who can use it? And you mentioned some of the uses. Are there any things that are forbidden on the trail?
No. We even have horses are allowed, not on the single track trails, but on the double track wide trails. What's also exciting about Kingdom Trails is we very much respect the traditional outdoor recreation opportunities in the kingdom, which is hunting. So we close our trails in order for the safety of our landowners and our members and hunters.
When did Kingdom Trails get started and how?
Yes, we celebrated our 25th anniversary last year. So we're 26 years old. We were founded in 1994. And I'm always in awe when I hear the stories of those beginning days as Kingdom Trails was the brainchild of local community members, local business, and people and leaders. And Doug Kitchell is one of our founders who's known throughout these parts. And he literally went door to door knocking on people's houses and just asking if trails could go through their properties. And he was the one that really sung the praises and shared the vision of what trails could do for the economy.
Now, you've just conserved this piece of property. So tell us about that.
Yes, this was, a long time coming. It was such an exciting campaign. Kingdom Trails joined forces with the Vermont Land Trust, who are the experts around town on conservation and stewardship.
Yep.
Because we really, it was more than just the outdoor recreation opportunities, more than just the trails. It was preserving the stunning landscape. Darling Ridge is just this beautiful 360 view of the Green Mountains and Burke Mountain specifically. And there's a trail that goes right over the property called Heaven's Bench with this iconic bench, an actual bench where you can sit and just take it all in. So more than the landscape, there's also just beautiful forests, agriculture land. The Passumpsic River runs through it, and we really wanted to make sure that these were protected in perpetuity.
Now, this was before you raised the money to conserve it. This was part of Kingdom Trails already. Is that correct?
It was. It was trails. There were about 7 miles of trails on the property. However, the property was not secured. As you mentioned earlier, it had been owned by the previous Burke Mountain owner, Ari Quiros. So the property was in receivership. And Kingdom Trails had caught wind of future development. And we didn't want to see that happen. We knew our neighbors on the ridge didn't want to see that happen. Because with development, that could come fragmentation of the landscape, the forests, and also our trails. So we really wanted to preserve, not just for ourselves, for the trail network, but also for our neighbors in the community.
So what did it cost? How did you raise the money?
it was a huge undertaking. We raised well over $600,000. We were so grateful. We wrote many grants, and a large portion of funding came from the Vermont Housing Conservation Board. We also had an anonymous donation of $150,000.
Oh my.
And we totaled, this blows my mind, 740 individual donations from anywhere from our local businesses to just, you know, folks from, I think, all the way from California, you know, who are donating and up in Canada. And it just, whenever I'm having a bad day, I think of this, and it's just such a warm fuzzy, you know, that people were able to give. And especially this year during a pandemic, I mean, there was almost a moment where we pulled the plug on this campaign where we really, should we even start this during the COVID situation, during this time of uncertainty? But we continued on because we really knew that outdoor recreation, outdoor space is so important, especially this year, because we wanted to keep this land open to the public so they had a place to nurture their mental and physical well-being during this wild time.
Oh, Abby, 740 contributors. That's a lot of support. So what have you heard from people and organizations about why they've stepped up for this piece of property and to help Kingdom Trails?
Absolutely. Well, as I mentioned, you know, this odd time we're living in, I think people really saw the value. But another, you know, aspect was as I mentioned, the property was owned by the former owner of Burke Mountain, which during that time in our community, I've had it described as to me as it was a dark cloud over our area, over the kingdom. And I think people were just so thrilled to contribute, to have this piece of property be a happy ending, to wipe away that past situation. And now we can look at this property and think positively and forever.
Take me up there to Heaven's Bench again and describe it. It sounds absolutely stunning.
It really is. You can just sit on that bench, and when you look to the east is Burke Mountain, the north is Canada, and Green Mountains on your other side. There's also just these beautiful historic inns. It's just the like definition of the true Vermont landscape. You see cows in the pasture. you see bikes sweeping by, families walking, and it goes, you know, it's miles and miles. You can go forever. You really have to come.
Is it a long hike up to Heaven's Bench from any particular point, or
no, actually that's why it's so accessible. Kingdom Trails actually has a trailhead, a parking hub right below, and you walk not even a quarter of a mile, and you can get right up to Heaven's Bench, and it's double track. So not only bikes, but on foot, and Nordic skis can get up there, fat bikes, and you can just lounge and have a picnic on the grassy knoll.
Quarter mile hike and lounging. Even I can do that. That sounds great.
That's my kind of trail activity, yeah.
Stop it. Abby, folks who have used this land might be curious about the conservation details. So should they expect any changes or new restrictions?
Absolutely not. I mean, the whole point of this campaign was to preserve it as it is. Like I mentioned before, we have 7 miles of outdoor recreation trails, and at this time, we don't even have plans for more miles. It was really just about protecting. It's always open to the public, so they're welcome to use the trails. But of course, when we close and we have hunting, they're also welcome to, with proper permissions and license, to enjoy the property for hunting seasons. So really nothing new. They will just be there for them forever.
That's interesting that, there's this, it almost seems like one would cancel out the other. The fact that you allow hunting, the fact that you have, skiing and, hiking and, mountain biking, and yet you've been able, and snow machines, but you've been able to work and have both. How is that possible?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great question. Yeah, the seasons and the, those types of recreation, absolutely. I believe they complement each other, mm-hmm. actually, and we work well with them. Kingdom Trails is part of such organizations as the Vermont Trails and Greenway Council, the Vermont Trails Alliance, and I'm side by side with VAS representatives and VASA representatives, and together we work and learn from each other, and we understand that trail use is not divided between motorized and non-motorized. It's or even waterways or horse use, you know.
Yeah.
We all sit next to each other.
Yeah.
And we know our voices are stronger together.
How much of your entire network of Kingdom Trails is this Darling Ridge piece? About what percentage?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if I could pinpoint the exact percentage, but probably close to 40% is on the ridge. And those are some of our original trails. They're the true bread and butter in the heart of the network. People love those trails, not only because they're fun, you know, downhill, and but they bring you by some of the most beautiful views.
And I'm going to throw something else out there that might, again, throw you, and I apologize. But as I mentioned at the start, I have heard everyone I've had on from the Kingdom in interviews have mentioned when they talk about an important and just an integral part of what's happening in the Kingdom is Kingdom Trails. Have you been able to ascertain what kind of economic impact Kingdom Trails has had on the Northeast Kingdom?
Absolutely. I'll preface this information by saying this is a non-COVID year.
Okay, and we'll talk about that next.
Yes, but so if there wasn't a pandemic going on, Kingdom Trails has actually been fortunate to partake in some economic development studies. So we've been able, through surveys, we know that we see on average about 135,000 visits a year, and about 75% of those visitors are coming from out of state, and those out of staters, or even out of the country. A lot of our members are from Canada,
mm-hmm.
our neighbors to the north, and when they come, they're staying overnight, they're eating food, they're drinking beer, bringing, you know, gifts of maple syrup home. And so that means that adds up. And through all that math, we've been able to determine that Kingdom Trails actually has a average of $10 million economic impact in the region every year.
Mm-hmm. Well, knowing that they drink our beer and take our maple syrup home, you can also add that they have impeccably great taste. You mentioned a lot coming from out of state, coming from Canada. So in this COVID year, how have things been affected there at Kingdom Trails?
Drastically, absolutely. It was very noticeable this summer. That we didn't have our Canadians coming, who actually make up almost 38% of our members. And there were restrictions on out-of-staters. They did come, especially during the summer months, but, now that we're open for the winter and COVID numbers have had a little uptick, we're not seeing them, greatly on the weekends. But with that, you know, looking always at the glass half full and the positive side of things, there was a huge uptick in Vermonters joining us, our own local community getting on the trails. People who'd never recreated before were out there. And that's truly because recreation and being outdoors not only helps you physically but mentally. It was really a chance for people to revitalize during such an off year.
That's great to hear. Let's go to the phones. We've got Rich joining us from Starksboro. Rich, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I have a couple questions for your guest.
Okay.
I heard the term VASA mentioned a little bit, but I hadn't heard any term like ATV or quads. I also heard greenways, whatever they are. And I understand that Greenways embrace ATVs. It's kind of like part of the package when you're involved with them. Can you kind of tell me about the ATVs and tell us, do they have to be off the trails during hunting season as well?
Thanks, Rich. Great questions.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rich. We actually don't share trails with the VASA network. We do share trails with VAST, with snow machine travel. Mm-hmm. When I was mentioning VASA, I was referring to on some councils, that statewide councils that Kingdom Trails serves on. I sit right next to Danny Hale, who's the executive director of VASA. So we work together with VASA on statewide trail advocacy, but at this time, Kingdom Trails does not share. The VASA network does not come over towards our area.
Gotcha. But VAST does, and that would be the snow machines,
yes.
Correct?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are there future plans for this piece, this Darling Ridge piece, or for Kingdom Trails?
Specifically for this piece of property is really just to keep it healthy and beautiful. Kingdom Trails wants to continue being good stewards of not only the trails, but everything else that makes the property so special. And future plans for Kingdom Trails is just to keep being there for people, mm-hmm. to keep true to our mission. And that's really, speaking to our private landowners every day. We're so grateful and we thank them for allowing trails to exist up in the kingdom because, they offer so much to our community.
Now, you and I have focused a lot on this conservation of Darling Ridge, but and you said that's about 40% of Kingdom Trails. I'd like you to kind of give me maybe one or two other spots that you really love in Kingdom Trails. And I know it's like picking a favorite child, but, maybe there's a few that really have some relevance for you.
Absolutely. I have to speak to the newest area of the network, which is in Essex County over in East Haven. It's, we call that area of the network Moose Haven, and there's so much beautiful, wildlife and really fun, different trails. A different experience than the rest of the network, a lot of downhill flowy trails. But personally, my favorite area is our White School network, which is right in downtown East Burke. So a lot of local businesses also enjoy those trails being so close to their businesses. But I like it because it's right behind my house. And I am so thrilled to say that I just had a baby boy this past summer, and every day I was able to get out on the trails with him and breathe in fresh air and expose him to the outside. And it was wonderful to have that opportunity right at my fingertips.
That is beautiful, Abby. And then how do people find out about the rules and the maps of the trails and things like that?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. It's very important.
Yeah.
We have a website, www.kingdomtrails.org. You can always call us and email us, info@kingdomtrails.org. We have amazing staff who are working in our Welcome Center that are happy to pick up the phone and answer any and all of your questions. Just come and visit. Come check it out for yourself.
Abby Long is the Executive Director of Kingdom Trails. Abby, thanks for being on with us today.
Rick, thank you so, so much.
That was my pleasure. CBS News is next. Then we'll have a chat with Sandy Roos of Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees, Baby Clothes, Tabitha Henry Luminaries, Holiday Ornaments, Cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. In this COVID pandemic world, we've seen a focus on all areas of the healthcare industry like never before because we've become dependent on these frontline professionals who work for healthcare organizations. We're fortunate to have these organizations and professionals here in Vermont, and one of them is Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. Joining me now is the president and CEO of CVHHH, Sandy Roos. Sandy, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great. Thanks, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, you can call us with your questions for Sandy Roos or to discuss your experiences with CVHHH. Our numbers are 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. And you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sandy, I hate to assume that everyone knows the vital information about an organization as I start an interview. So give people a brief introduction to the work that CVHHH does.
Sure, Rick. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to do that. So ultimately, Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice takes care of individuals prenatal, individuals that are pregnant and going to have a baby, and working with them on parenting and around expecting that child into their home, right through to end-of-life care. So, you know, we have maternal and child health programs, and that goes into our home health programs, which are those services that we provide that need skilled care, such as the care of a nurse or a therapist or a medical social worker, home health aide. And then we also have our hospice program, which has touched many, many lives in our community and caring not only for the patient, but for their family during that very difficult time in their home, and really supporting them and the family members and providing bereavement to them after their loved one has passed away. And then also we have a whole long-term care program, which is really a non-medically necessary program, but it's those vital services such as doing errands, doing laundry, providing homemaking services, companionship, et cetera, that keep individuals in their home as long as they possibly can, in their community, surrounded by their families, friends, pets, neighbors, et cetera, so they don't have to go into a facility living situation.
That is a wide breadth of services, Sandy.
It is.
How many?
And we also do flu clinics as well as foot care clinics.
Oh, my gosh.
So...
Now that you say it, you're probably thinking to yourself, I can't believe we do all this stuff.
It's been 100 plus years in the making.
Wow. And how many people are employed by CVHHH?
We have employed between 180 and 190 employees.
Okay. That makes sense now.
Yes. And the majority are direct care staff. There's probably about 55 administrative staff.
Wow. You've been involved with the organization for over 20 years, I believe. So why is CVHHH so important to you?
Well, I was born when my mom was 40. So I was kind of the unwanted surprise, so to speak.
Yep.
And I guess I've been around older adults all my life. And I know for both my mom and dad, my dad worked three jobs, and my mom basically helped him with one of his businesses and took care of all of us, four children. And their home was their sanctuary. Mm. And that's where they wanted to be when they aged. That's where they went when they wanted to just have calm and peace. When times got tough, I remember my mom just sitting at the table having her tea, and my dad would come home. We hadn't seen him in days from just working different shifts through his three jobs, and he just wanted to sit in his chair and relax and watch football or 60 Minutes or the news or just read.
Did you grow up in my house?
That was their peace. That was their peace and quiet, and we made sure we gave that to them.
Yeah. So, Sandy, now everyone is vitally concerned about COVID, especially in our healthcare community. So where's your staff in line for receiving COVID vaccines?
So our staff are considered part of priority 1A. So certainly we've, the majority of our direct care staff, which are those individuals that are patient facing, so it's going into patients' homes on a regular basis, have been vaccinated. We've had, you know, close to like an 85% vaccination rate of those individuals, which is really great. Obviously, there are some staff that have to consult with their health care provider, and with some of the unknowns, they may be being given advice not to do it right now. And, of course, some individuals just have their own opinion of wanting to wait a little bit. But we have been in line and ready, and the majority of our staff have at least gotten their first vaccine.
Well, as medical professionals, that 85% rate is pretty high. So what message are they sending to their community by rolling up their sleeves and getting that shot?
Really, I think it is, you know, the goal of the governor is to save Vermont lives and really to protect those that are most vulnerable. And most of those individuals are those older adults and those frail elderly and disabled that we are seeing on a regular basis. And we really want to get as many individuals vaccinated as possible. There's a lot of information out there on the web with from the CDC and certainly from Central Vermont Medical Center, who has been the hub of distributing these vaccinations. And really, I think what the medical community is saying is definitely the negative could outweigh, the positive definitely outweighs the negative at this point in time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, especially for those individuals that have multiple chronic diseases and all of that, those with CHF, congestive heart failure, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, it could really impact them very negatively, COVID could. And certainly if they can get a vaccine and maybe have a few side effects that aren't life-threatening, it could certainly keep them from a life-threatening situation in the future.
And then the people you work with, your clients, especially those who are older and in the more vulnerable areas, how are you communicating to them about getting the vaccine?
So right now, everything's still in a bit of a flux.
Yep.
And we are working in tandem with the Vermont Department of Health through our trade association, VNAs of Vermont. And then also we are going to be partnering with Central Vermont Medical Center because in the throughout the state, the 14 hospitals are the hub of vaccination distribution. So ultimately what we want to do is partner with them, try to have some sort of a coordinated effort and work with different areas throughout our community to get the information we need and send that messaging out. Ultimately, Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice and other VNAs throughout the state are planning on vaccinating the patients that are on service with them. And I think it's just more or less the semantics and logistics of how to do that in a coordinated way. So for those individuals, the vaccine is coming. We don't have all the details worked out right now. The state's priority currently is still priority 1A, which is for healthcare providers, EMS, our first responders, et cetera. And I know they are working on, the state is working on a plan to roll out information for the next age band, which they will be starting with, which is 75 years and older. So we're trying to coordinate different points of distribution pods, which we call, whether it's in a congregate setting location or a homeless location setting or out in the community through a partner such as Central Vermont Home Health or other venues that we've been delivering other care and support through COVID. And certainly there'll be public clinics as well.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the vaccine's rolling out, you know, kind of slowly, and we're waiting for more vaccines to come to the state. So it will take a while to get everyone vaccinated with the COVID vaccine. So, you know, the protocols are still the important part of this equation. So what are the protocols that your staff has been using during the pandemic?
Well, certainly when this all started in March, it was definitely an all hands on deck. And I think for everyone, it was the fear of the virus and how it was transmitted and then also having appropriate personal protective equipment. And for home health, it functions a little bit differently. A lot of the agencies, not all, have used, you know, do use face shields and obviously medical surgical masks on a regular basis, at times an N95, certainly gowns, gloves, etc. But we do not keep large stockpiles of those because what we do is we get that those PPE and then we drop ship it to patients' homes. So we don't necessarily have a huge inventory. So it took us a few weeks in conjunction with the VNAs of Vermont to really get a good quantity of that personal protective equipment, but we did have that quantity to initially start caring for those individuals that were COVID positive. So we really never shut our doors, and we started that right away. And I think for Central Vermont, the phasing in of COVID was a little bit slower at the beginning, which was really helpful, especially those individuals that needed that extra support at home by home health. So we were very well equipped. You know, being in home care for all these years, the one thing I've learned is we have to remain really nimble. So we are able to really, you know, flip that switch fairly quickly. This certainly was different than anything else as a pandemic, but we've participated in, you know, different issues such as this with the state over the years. So it was just a matter of the PPE, I think, was the most significant, and really just helping staff understand how the virus was transmitted and learning information as we go. So that probably was the biggest hurdle for us. And now staff gear up on a regular basis. They wear face shields when they go into the home. That actually puts them at lowest risk of exposure. So we've been fortunate to have a very, very minimal number of staff that have contracted the virus. There have only been three individuals, and two of those out of the three were definitely community acquired versus anything else. And we do have COVID positive patients on service on a regular basis. We've been averaging 5 to 10 at any given time through today.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Sandy, human contact is a bit out of fashion during our new socially distanced reality, but that it makes it difficult to check on your clients. So what have you been doing to reduce these interactions?
Right. So, Rick, that is definitely the case. Our goal was really to mitigate exposure during COVID for both our patients, clients, and families, as well as our staff. So we were in a really fortunate place. Once again, I told you in home care, we try to remain nimble. And Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice has had a telemonitor program in place since 2007. As a result of having that system, which is compromises of having a telehealth manager here in the office that monitors a panel of patients on a regular basis, our clients have what is similar to a Samsung tablet in their home. And that has video visit capabilities as well. So we were very quickly able to check on those individuals through video and look at their frequency of visit patterns and the number of disciplines that were going in, whether it was a nurse or a therapist or potentially a home health aide. And for any of those services that were beyond, like, the personal care services of bathing, et cetera, we really had to look at what makes most sense to be an in-person visit versus a remote visit versus a telephone visit. And knowing that we had, you know, and then categorizing high risk, medium risk, and low risk as to, you know, certainly one of our biggest goals was to keep these individuals out of the hospital. Those are our sickest patients that are on that program. So those could be definitely the most vulnerable. So we wanted to keep them in a safe and isolated place. In addition to that, we had iPads, and we were fortunate to be a receiver of a grant through the Vermont Program of Healthcare Quality, a connectivity grant, where we had we were given not only iPads, but also Wi-Fi boosters. So that really helped all of our programs throughout the organization in possibly deploying technology that allowed them all to stay connected in a different way.
Well,
and then for those individuals that were on our long-term care program and very nervous about having their personal care attendant come in regularly and really trying to space out, well, instead of doing groceries for a week, we do it for 2 weeks. So we had one of our personal care attendants calling these individuals on a regular basis just to check in, just to, you know, make sure they're not feeling too isolated, making sure we've met their needs, that they're, if they're working with other providers, how can we connect them and get them what they need. And sometimes those conversations were, you know, less than a minute, and sometimes they were up to 48 minutes. So we really tried to stay connected both visually and telephonically, as well as in person throughout this whole thing.
Well, I understand the need for remote and telemedicine visits in place of being there in person during this pandemic, but how effective are they as opposed to being there with a client?
They're actually very effective, and I think we're seeing that throughout our medical system, and this is not uncommon. It has been around for a very long time, maybe not as much as in Vermont, but certainly in other states. And I think what it allows is it actually allows us to enhance the care that's being provided, especially in a home health setting. If we can have multiple individuals basically touching that client on a regular basis, then we are more apt to notice and identify change in condition, which ultimately leads to keeping them out of the hospital, keeping them out of the emergency room, and being able to care for them at home and notice any sort of exacerbations that may be coming down the pike. And certainly identifying other, you know, other social determinants of health that they may need during this time that arise. You know, anybody can ultimately go into a crisis at any point in time. So it really allows us to keep touch. So we haven't necessarily replaced visits per se, at least now that we've come a bit out of COVID, although we're still kind of on red alert. But we've certainly been able to enhance the care that we're providing, and that's the ultimate goal.
Now, how have the clients of CVHHH responded to the use of telemedicine and, you know, more of these remote processes?
Right. So some, it just doesn't work well.
Mm-hmm.
And as if it doesn't work well, then we don't do it. And we set ourselves up to make in-person visits only. For others, very receptive. For some, we still have connectivity issues. Oh. So it's not going to work. And just for some, it just doesn't feel like the right type of care. So this is not, you have to do this. This is, we have this to offer. This is why we want to offer it. This is how we think it will enhance the care that we're providing based on your care plan.
Yeah.
And if we can do this, we'd like the opportunity. And we really try to have people try it. But certainly we don't force it upon them.
Good. I do like, you've thought of so many things you mentioned earlier, Wi-Fi boosters, and the connectivity issue that you really looked at. That's really important, and I applaud you for that. Now, is this something you think you'll utilize more post-pandemic? And that is my favorite hyphenated word right now, post-pandemic.
It absolutely is. Because we've always had a program, and we've really, COVID actually accelerated our ability to implement it. And this is certainly a goal. We're piloting different things with this program. We're piloting having a nurse practitioner work with us, certainly for the population that's on a telemonitor as part of their care plan for those high-risk individuals to keep them out of the hospital. We're looking at an Echo Duo type device, which can help facilitate potentially what an EKG may look like in the home, to certainly get to the doctor and cardiologist and work with them. And it is just another way, like I said, of improving care. So when we look at our strategic plan, ultimately quality of care is significant to our work. And anything that we can do to enhance that, we are certainly doing it. Now every referral that comes into our organization, we look at including telehealth visits into that plan of care.
How has staffing been at CVHHH through the pandemic, Sandy?
Right. So workforce in general, I think in the state of Vermont and especially in healthcare, has been a challenge. I can honestly say that what we try to do is keep as many people employed as possible during this and redeployed individuals, et cetera. We did have some that had just had to be home, couldn't make the commitment for whatever reason, whether it was child care or their own health condition, et cetera. But ultimately, the staff have been pretty amazing. And many have wanted to stand up and help in any given way. I know we had personal care attendants working with IT staff to make face shields. Like I said, we had personal care attendants making phone calls to patients. Certainly staff were willing and learning to do video visits, whether they were at home or not. But overall, workforce is a significant challenge. There is a significant nursing shortage, which we are all aware of, and it is a significant strategic planning focus for us over the next 3 years. I know one of the major things that we did in a very small step in the strategy of really boosting our capacity from a workforce perspective is we have raised our minimum wage to $15 an hour. And that came with unanimous support from our personnel and finance committees, as well as our board. And that's just one way of us recognizing that the people that are taking care of individuals in their home have a passion for this work. And they have some sort of experience or some sort of heartfelt something or other that this is what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't only start at being a personal care attendant. We want to support individuals to pursue a career in home health and either do, stay in the personal care attendant world as a licensed nurse assistant, really try to work with them to further their education into becoming an LPN or an RN or even a therapist for that matter. So we are going to have a significant focus on that. We hired more recently an amazing nurse educator, Elena Martell. She's originally from Central Vermont, and she has a real passion for wanting to give back to her community. Her parents are deeply rooted in the community, and we're very fortunate to have a lot of people and a lot of our staff live in the community. So when your neighbor's unsafe, you don't sleep well at night. And you want to make sure you can do everything you can to support these individuals in their home.
Sandy, in just under a minute, if there's someone in the healthcare profession listening right now, what would you tell them about your mission and why they'd enjoy the opportunity to work at CVHHH?
So I have the opportunity to actually interview anyone that's leaving the organization. I put myself out there to do that. Mm-hmm. And if they agree, you know, I think what I've heard the most is that individuals, especially nurses, are able to use their skills in no other way and in no other place than in the home. You are really able to work at the top of your license. You are able to learn the full spectrum of what you've been trained in school in a hands-on environment. We have patients that are experiencing all sorts of medical complexities and conditions. And I think that's been the biggest thing, that you are actually going to see such a wide array, and you do still have the ability to focus. We have wound care certified staff. We have staff that are very focused on PICC lines and IVs. We have other staff that are, you know, more well-versed in congestive heart failure and COPD. Everybody learns all of that, but ultimately we need experts as well on staff. So we're very fortunate. We use technology. Like I said, all our direct care staff either have a tablet or a laptop, and you really are able to work at the top of your license. Even as an LNA, you can.
Sandy, I'm going to have to leave it there, but yeah. I thank you so much. Sandy Roos is president and CEO of Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Rick. Take care.
You too. Take care.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli is putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs. Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. The Vermont brand. Yes, it really does carry weight and mean something to people beyond our borders. It's that unfailing commitment to quality that Vermont companies put into their products. You might be thinking about our beers and cheeses, our granite, marble, and slate, and you'd be right to go there. But there's a company based in Randolph that's been around since 1920, and for the people who use their products, there can be no shortcuts, no drop-off in quality. The company makes gloves, and before you think, what's so special about gloves? Stick around and have a listen. Sam Hooper is president of Vermont Glove, formerly known as Green Mountain Glove. And the name isn't the only change that has gone on there. We'll learn all about that. Sam Hooper, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick, thanks a lot for having me on. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you have a question for Sam or if you've used Vermont Gloves, give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, 100 years old, 1920, so I guess you're going to turn 101. Give us a little history about the company, Sam.
Yeah, so we've been around since 1920, manufacturing handmade leather work gloves in Randolph, Vermont. And we started initially as making silk dress gloves for women at that time, back in the 20s. And then the European market had a pretty strong, good stronghold on that, and the company began to struggle, and right around that time was FDR's Electrify America, Rural America program. And so there was a need to create utility gloves for journeymen and line workers who were, building out, all of the infrastructure across the country. So that's when, the Hopp family, teamed up with Central Vermont Power to figure out and prototype what we call our leather protectors. So we make the leather glove that goes over a 20,000 volt rated rubber glove. And this, we're basically making a protector that protects the protector. So that's where your point about quality really matters, is because, if our glove gets a hole in it, or there's a break in the grain of the leather that we didn't know, and we put that onto a line worker's hand, and then they, while they're working, put a puncture through their rubber glove, that could be a life or death situation. Yeah. So we're in our fourth generation of Hopp family glove makers today, and Heidi Hopp is our operations manager, and she's a part owner in the business, and I purchased the company from her dad 3 years ago now.
Wow. So, we've heard so much during this pandemic about pivoting. There probably has never been a bigger pivot in industry than going from manufacturing women's silk gloves to the gloves that you make, these leather gloves. And really describe in detail, Sam, for people, what this glove is, the Vermont glove that you make.
Yeah, sure. So one of the nice things about being a small family business and not having to answer to shareholders and, or higher ups, we can make decisions on the fly, and we can, implement things rather quickly without having a million and one hoops to jump through. So, over the years, we had three locations in Randolph, and then as equipment changed, so initially we were using metal dies, so basically cookie cutters like you use when you're making Christmas cookies, mm-hmm. And we would hit them with a hammer, and that would stamp out the silk and cottons that we were using back in the day to make the ladies' riding gloves. As our industry changed and we saw the opportunity in the utility sector, we moved to what are called clicker and die cutting presses. And these are, and we still use these in our factory today. They're from 1930s, and they basically run on centrifugal force, and they stamp out, the metal dies. So rather than using hammer, we're now using an industrial press. And so we use goat leather for our product, and the reason we use goat leather is because it is a superior product to that of cowhide for this application. Cowhide's got its place for ruggedness in boot manufacturing and other products, but with gloves, you really need the dexterity. And when you're thinking about wearing a rather thick, 20,000 volt rubber glove that goes up to your elbow, you're already limited with your dexterity right then, and just wearing that glove. Now you're going to put a leather glove over that rubber glove, and so you really need a supple material that can allow you to still work a wrench while wearing both of those gloves. So goat skin is it performs better because it's extraordinarily durable, but it has a lot of lanolin, some natural oils in the hide that allow it to stay supple and soft, much like deer skin or sheep. But deer and sheep don't have the durability factor that that the goat does. So we use goat skin operationally. That makes it, that's, you know, relatively challenging because you're dealing with a lot smaller of a hide than, say, a cow. You're also dealing with full hides, so you're getting a variance in stretch through the neck, shoulders, hind legs, and then the thickness of the leather changes from each part of the hide. So there's a lot of know-how that goes into our cutting process, which is what is called nesting. And it's basically you're trying to maximize the use of the hide by positioning the dyes on it in the most efficient way. So you're minimizing as much waste as possible. So we call that nesting. It's like playing a game of Tetris on your phone. And that takes a lot of skill because of the stretch of the leather. If I'm cutting, for example, if I'm cutting a palm piece, I need the stretch of the leather to be naturally go width-wise across my palm, across my knuckles, rather than, you know, up and down my palm towards the tips of my fingers, because it will eventually, as the glove wears in, it will stretch and become a different size. So there's a lot of know-how in just the cutting process, and then our patterns are all unique to our company. So we we patented everything back in '50s, and that our thumb constructions are really give a range of motion and a comfortability that really set our gloves apart from other gloves out there. And that's the only way to survive in our business these days. We have to find ways to set ourselves apart.
Well, let's talk about survival, because a few years ago, people might remember the Green Mountain glove was barely surviving, was on its last legs. What was happening there?
Yeah, I think there's a number of things that contributed to that over the years. So for starters, you got the 1980s roll along, and you have overseas manufacturing taking off. And so now you're finding cheaper labor markets to manufacture goods. Then in the 90s, you have trade globalization. So you got NAFTA, you got the ease of transport from products from from Asia and South America and other places across the world, bringing those onto either coast of the U.S., and then in the 2000s, we saw a significant consolidation within the utility sector. So, we know about this just here in Vermont, for example. Green Mountain Power's merger with Central Vermont Power and, various other relationships like that. That is basically what happened all across the U.S. and in many cases in, huge companies buying mom and pop rural electrical utility providers. So when you have a company, a mom and pop electrical utility company, go from buying gloves for, say, 20 to 30 line workers, and they've got a relationship with Green Mountain Glove, they've got a relationship with the Hop family, they know our quality, then all of a sudden they're bought by a bigger company that's got a centralized purchasing agent who is now buying for 5,000 line workers, all of a sudden that price number on the line sheet becomes very, very, a lot more important to that centralized buyer. But they may not understand they may not even know the SKU number, what they're buying. So they don't understand the quality difference from my product to, say, some of my competitors that are, basically chasing the volume game designed to make commodity gloves. So
you took over in 2018. So what were the first steps you took in trying to turn around this respected brand?
Yeah. So one of the huge things that interests me in the business was the quality. So, grew up working on the farm, wearing these gloves, and after, using a cheaper product, going through many, many pairs through the winter, and then, transitioning to Green Mountain Glove, wearing those on my hands and realizing the value proposition of being able to go through, 5 to 6 pairs versus one pair. is a, you know, is a significant off product offering, but this, there needs to, you really have to tell that story. So I, my vision for the company was to leverage our position in the trade sector, you know, outfitting utility professionals and tradespeople with 100 years of experience and reputation of quality there, and leverage that in order to become also a consumer facing brand. Because frankly, I think just many, most Vermonters just didn't know that there was such amazing gloves being made
right.
in Randolph, Vermont. So finding a way to make it more accessible for ordinary consumers to purchase and buy into the brand, was, you know, a significant first step in the right direction for us. And that meant, you know, I wrestled with the idea of changing the name. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to do that. And, you know, I met with the Hopp family and obviously did not want to disrespect any legacy there, but I also felt the need that we needed to leverage Vermont and the cachet that Vermont holds in order to become a consumer-facing brand that people across the country will buy, because it costs us a lot to run our factory, and that means we need a certain amount of product to go out the door and be sold every year.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to reach a little bit further than just our local backyard. And that's proven to work really well for us, transitioning from Green Mountain Glove to Vermont Glove. And we're growing. We're healthy. You know, we built out a website so people could learn about us, and we navigate many selling channels now. We still make gloves for utility and trade professionals, but we also sell a lot of gloves to consumers, and that's in both brick and mortar retail and online. And we're grateful for our retail partnerships across Vermont, where, you know, people can learn about our brand, try our gloves on, such as Common Gear in Burlington, Lenny's in Barrie and Williston, Elevation Clothing in Woodstock, Gearhouse in Randolph. You know, that those guys have really done an amazing job of helping us get our name out there.
Hey, you mentioned the factory, and I want to talk about that because it's a throwback. I think it was a creamery. You moved over there in 1960. It's really kind of from a different age, but you've made some changes there to really kind of bring that up as well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful historic building. We had three locations in Randolph prior to moving into the Whiting Milk Creamery, and when we moved in, we turned it into a cut-and-sew operation. One challenge of it is we are on two floors, but it is an old mill-style building, and we are right along the railroad tracks, which is cool, and used to have a rail siding there, which is no longer. But one thing that the building offers is tons of natural light with great big windows, which is awesome for your electricity bill, but it was definitely killing us on the heating bill for a while there. So we, when I first took over, we were burning 28 ton of coal annually to heat the building. And it was an uninsulated space that was, you know, pretty breezy. So from an employee comfortability standpoint, there was a reason to change. From a financial standpoint, there's a reason to change. And most importantly, from a climate responsibility standpoint, there is a need to change in my mind. So I embarked on net zeroing, which is a term that most people don't really understand. It's what it means is we run our factory on 100% renewable energy today. So that's our electricity comes from a solar array on the roof, which Catamount Solar put in, and then our pellet boiler, which is a pretty significant investment that Sunwood Biomass at Waitsfield put in, and that allows us to, and so those are softwoods that are considered renewable because it's forest management. And that's really important for us because A, now the building's a lot cleaner. B, we are paying attention to our carbon footprint. C, our hireability and employees are a lot happier. And D, we are contributing to the Northeast New England economy and the Vermont economy for the forest industry. So those, while that was a huge investment for us, the whole purpose that we're in in business is because we want to use our company as a platform to do better and be more responsible. And that means creating jobs, but that also means taking care of our carbon footprint. So if we weren't going to be a net zero factory, then I don't know how interested I would be in being a manufacturer.
Interesting. So, Sam, I think you've done some work in expanding the product line, getting not just working on the industrial side, but more on the consumer side. As a matter of fact, Outside Magazine chose your gloves as one of the best gloves of 2021. So on the consumer side, what have you kind of done to position them there?
Yeah, so leveraging the brand and telling the story of quality and just helping people understand that we really feel like we have the best glove sellers in the world. And then using our skill on the making side to be able to prototype and create gloves that the consumer market, is ripe for was super important to me. I didn't want to move away from our utilitarian values and kind of who we are. So it's still a very rugged looking, utilitarian glove. We stitch our seams on the outside, which is common in the trade sector, which is very uncommon in the consumer sector. And that gives us a unique look, but there's also performance features there. That allows me, it's called a moccasin stitch seam, that allows me to use thicker leather. So our gloves will inherently last longer. We can double stitch every seam rather than using a smaller gauge thread and single stitching the seams. That makes the gloves last longer. And then they're also the seams are all positioned to roll back and be behind your hand. So you actually get an increased dexterity and certainly an increased comfortability because you don't have these bulky seams binding and rubbing against your hand. So we kept our utilitarian style, but that glove that Outside Magazine and the Boston Globe have dubbed as one of the best gloves is 2021 is because we wanted to target backcountry skiers. You know, it's interesting seeing the gear being bought up in the backcountry ski industry. You know, these are folks who want to avoid going to resorts, but, you know, walk up the mountain in order to ski down it. Kind of a crazy concept, but we know that person is willing to buy quality gloves. And so with our removable merino wool liner, that allows you, because you get pretty warm hiking up, so you can, you know, hike up with just your shell on, then you get to the summit, put your merino wool liner in the glove, and it's got a wax canvas powder cuff that you can cinch down around your jacket so you can keep snow out. And, that, you know, the relationship between the liner and the shell is also important from a, if you want to wash them and dry them easier, keep them clean. But then you can also still run this glove as a work glove come spring and fall. You know, if you're just doing your firewood. So the versatility there is definitely, you know, something that's cool. We're a big believer in using natural products. So we really try to stay away from the synthetics. I'm not going to speak to where we're going to go in the future, but right now we're a big believer in our utilitarian values and our natural products that are biodegradable.
We're getting short on time, but you took over the business in 2018. It's now 2021. So, how have things changed as far as how many employees and how, you know, sales are going for Vermont Glove?
Yeah, so we're growing rapidly, which I'm excited about. Obviously, when you know, you're going from a really tough spot to somewhere that does feel like really fast growth. But when I took over, we had two employees. We have eight now, and we've had as many as 10. We're kind of at our sweet spot right now. We are going to be hiring in 2021. Obviously, 2020 with the pandemic was an interesting year with lots of unknowns and uncertainties and difference in, you know, not knowing what markets were going to perform in which ways. And luckily we fared well. We did make the decision back in March to transition and pivot the whole product line. We halted glove production and we made masks. So we ended up producing some 56,000 masks, and we donated about 10 or 12,000 of those to hospitals and frontline healthcare workers, and then we tried to sell the rest at basically cost of production. And you know, that was private businesses and what you call B2B transactions, mm-hmm. business to business. So we did Green Mountain Coffee, Ben and Jerry's, Food Science, Rhino Foods, Lake Champlain Chocolate, you know, a lot of the larger yep. companies with many employees who were not able to get the PPE gear that they needed, and to keep people on the, you know, keep them manufacturing in a safe manner. So that was something that was really important. It cash flowed us. It kept our lights on and made it so I didn't have to furlough or lay any of our employees off. It actually allowed us to bring on 80 plus home sewers around the state of Vermont
wow.
who were either volunteering their time because they believed in the initiative that we were doing, or they were being paid by the piece per mask that they made. And we tried to manage that in a really safe way by doing by putting kits of 50 to 100 together that we would cut in the factory. And then
Sam, we're going to have to leave it there today. Sam Hooper is the president of Vermont Glove and Randolph, now beginning its 101st year. Sam, thank you so much for letting us know about the company.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rick. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. That's it for today on Vermont Viewpoint. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.